WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This President's Day, we're going to listen back to presidential speeches from the 20th century and consider some of the changes in what presidents say and how they say it. My guests, Sam Berlowski and Cooper Graham, compiled a CD box set that collects historic presidential speeches from 1908 to 1993. Berlowski and Graham work in the Library of Congress's Division of Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound. Their CD of presidential speeches is a co-production of the Library of Congress and Rhino Records. I spoke with them when the CD was released in 1995. In a moment, we'll hear an excerpt of President Roosevelt's first fireside chat, broadcast just weeks after he took office in 1933 during the Great Depression. I asked Berlowski about the significance of this speech.
What he did was he went directly to the people. He didn't give a speech to Congress. He didn't go to a major organization. He went directly to the people. And this was a very significant thing that Roosevelt did by going to the people so often through radio. It sort of usurped machine politics at the time. One traces the descendancy of machine politics to Franklin Roosevelt and the fact that he skips over them and goes directly to the people over the radio through what were called intimate chats.
So before we hear this 1933 fireside chat, Roosevelt's first fireside chat, tell us what the crisis is that he's addressing so we can hear this in context.
There was a depression, and the depression had gotten worse and worse to the point where a lot of banks were having all their money pulled by anxious depositors who felt that all the banks were going to fail. Of course, any bank has far more deposits in it than it has cash on hand, so the banks would have... there would have been a run on all the banks in the United States, and there would have been complete financial panic. Roosevelt has a reputation of being a liberal, but at that point, I think the business community was sufficiently frightened that they were also asking that he take any steps that were necessary to try to avert this crisis. I don't think most people now can imagine how serious it was. So there was an awful lot riding on the speech to try to persuade Americans not to pull their money out of the banks.
So let's hear it. This is Franklin Roosevelt, his first fireside chat, 1933.
First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, in bonds and commercial paper and mortgages, and in many other kinds of loans. In other words, the bank puts your money to work to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning round. A comparatively small part of the money that you put into the bank is kept in currency, an amount which in normal times is wholly sufficient to cover the cash needs of the average citizen. In other words, the total amount of all the currency in the country is only a comparatively small proportion of the total deposits in all the banks of the country. What then happened during the last few days of February and the first few days of March? Because of undermined confidence on the part of the public, there was a general rush by a large portion of our population to turn bank deposits into currency or gold, a rush so great that the soundest banks couldn't get enough currency to meet the demand. The reason for this was that on the spur of the moment, it was, of course, impossible to sell perfectly sound assets of a bank and convert them into cash except at panic prices far below their real value.
Franklin Roosevelt recorded in 1933 his first fireside chat. What was the public reaction to that first chat?
It was very, very favorable. The expected panic didn't take place, which is negative evidence, but seemed to be proof that a lot of people listened to the speech and took the president's words to heart. Also, there was an incredible amount of mail. The White House received something like four or five times the mail it had received after a speech by the previous administrations, to the point where They had to hire extra people to deal with it. So the response to Roosevelt's speech was overwhelming. One commentator says that within the space of this speech, capitalism was saved. Maybe it was.
On this new CD box set, you've included a speech by President Truman, recorded in 1948, upon accepting the Democratic nomination for president. Why did you choose this speech from Truman?
Going into this campaign, Truman was very much the underdog. Most people didn't think he had much of a chance. And his speaking style was generally considered to be terrible. It was a very flat, pronounced Missouri accent, and people had been talking to him for years about changing his style, trying to make his sentence shorter and punchier. And if he really could speak to an audience the way he could speak to friends of his at a poker game, he would be a wonderful speaker. And for some reason, at 2 o'clock in the morning of his acceptance speech of the Democratic candidate in 48, he seemed to take their advice to heart, because you hear Truman at his best in this speech.
Let's hear an excerpt of this speech, Harry Truman, from 1948, at the Democratic National Convention. He's accepting the nomination for president.
Confidence and security have been brought to the American people by the Democratic Party. Farm income has increased from less than $2.5 billion in 1933 to more than $18 billion in 1947. Never in the world were the farmers of any republic or any kingdom or any other country as prosperous as the farmers of the United States. And if they don't do their duty by the Democratic Party, they're the most ungrateful people in the world. Wages and salaries in this country have increased from $29 billion in 1933 to more than $128 billion in 1947. That's labor. And labor never had but one friend in politics, and that was the Democratic Party and Franklin D. Roosevelt. And I'll say to labor just what I've said to the farmers. They are the most ungrateful people in the world if they pass the Democratic Party by this year.
Harry Truman accepting the Democratic presidential nomination in 1948. I don't know if you'll agree with me on this, but it seems to me a presidential candidate would never call voters ungrateful. I mean, you don't say anything that could alienate any voters. What do you think?
I certainly agree with you. On the other hand, as Cooper said, this was 2 a.m. in the morning, so I'm not sure how many voters heard this address.
But there was also a drifting away, both by labor and by some of the farmers in 48, and I think would not be considered to be necessarily a judicious thing to do, but it may have reminded them exactly who their friends were, and I think I would have been somewhat impressed by it if I'd been a union man or a farmer in 48.
Let's jump ahead to 1969. You've included an address by President Nixon to the nation on the war in Vietnam. Why did you include this speech?
Well, this is the silent majority speech. In making the selections for this set, which were mostly done by Cooper here, we decided, or Cooper had a great idea, that for current recent presidents and the current presidents, and we started this thing during the Bush administration, that we would contact the presidents or their staffs or families to see what speech they would like to be represented by. Initially, this was a contact to say, gee, we're going to preserve a speech in a special new process with some experiments we're doing at the Library of Congress. What speech would you like to be assured was preserved for posterity? And all of the presidents or their families, from Mrs. Onassis on, responded, but the Nixon office did not respond to Cooper.
Therefore, we decided to go with a speech that President Nixon admired. He had mentioned very favorably In the Arena. I mean, that's the book, one of the books. He had mentioned his silent majority speech several times as being one of his best, and also he felt one that changed public opinion in the United States, so we decided to go along with it. And of course, the silent majority is one of the best-known sort of catchwords of the period. Also, since it deals with Vietnam, we thought it was a topical, not a topical speech, but a speech that dealt with that that epoch in American history. So for these reasons, we decided to go with a silent majority speech. It was evidently partly the speech that some commentators have said marked out a new group in the United States, some Democrat, some Republican, that might vote for Republicans in the future. And this, in fact, seems to have been a pretty accurate prediction.
Okay, Richard Nixon, recorded in 1969.
I have chosen a plan for peace. I believe it will succeed. If it does not succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. Or if it does succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. If it does not succeed, anything I say then won't matter. I know it may not be fashionable to speak of patriotism or national destiny these days, but I feel it is appropriate to do so on this occasion. 200 years ago, this nation was weak and poor. But even then, America was the hope of millions in the world. Today, we have become the strongest and richest nation in the world. And the wheel of destiny has turned, so that any hope the world has for the survival of peace and freedom will be determined by whether the American people have the moral stamina and the courage to meet the challenge of free world leadership. Let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace. I have initiated a plan of action which will enable me to keep that pledge. The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed. For the more divided we are at home, the less likely the enemy is to negotiate at Paris. Let us be united for peace. Let us also be united against defeat. Because let us understand, North Vietnam cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only America can do that.
President Nixon's silent majority address, recorded in 1969, on the war in Vietnam. You know, it's interesting. I mean, he didn't reprise the words silent majority a lot during that address. What do you think it was about those words that caught on?
I think that sort of that, I don't know, I guess the polarizing aspect of the speech is what made it catch on, by dividing the public into camps. It's important to remember that the context of this speech is all these mass demonstrations going on outside the White House at the time. So by calling someone silent, you're placing them, in comparison to these dirty hippies who were, you know, burning flags and having these sort of, in many cases, you know, unseemly protests going on in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial.
My guests are Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress. In 1995, they produced a box set of presidential speeches of the 20th century. That set is still in print. Now, let's jump ahead to President Clinton. You've chosen a speech from 1993, his remarks to the convocation of the Church of God in Christ. What is this speech about, and what do you think it shows about Clinton's style of speech making?
Well, this speech is about race in the United States and class and economic policy in the United States. I think it was a very successful speech for him, at least in its immediate response. It was to an African-American audience in Memphis. I think that, as Troop Cooper said earlier about President Truman, Clinton has a very good reputation for one-on-one speaking. He's a very charismatic speaker privately, and I don't think that his reputation is as good as a public speaker, but I think he tries to be somewhat intimate, if that's a word you can be, with the hundreds or thousands listening to this speech.
Okay, this is President Clinton, an excerpt of a speech to the Convocation of the Church of God in Christ, 1993.
If Martin Luther King, who said, like Moses, I am on the mountaintop and I can see the promised land, but I'm not going to be able to get there with you. But we will get there. If he were to reappear by my side today and give us a report card on the last 25 years, what would he say? Say, you did a good job, he would say, voting and electing people who formerly were not electable because of the color of their skin. You have more political power, and that is good. You did a good job, he would say, letting people who have the ability to do so live wherever they want to live, go wherever they want to go in this great country. You did a good job, he would say, elevating people of color into the ranks of the United States Armed Forces to the very top, or into the very top of our government. You did a very good job, he would say. He would say, you did a good job creating a black middle class of people who really are doing well, and the middle class is growing more among African Americans than among non-African Americans. You did a good job. You did a good job in opening opportunity. But he would say, I did not live and die to see the American family destroyed. I did not live and die to see 13-year-old boys get automatic weapons and gun down 9-year-olds just for the kick of it. I did not live and die to see young people destroy their own lives with drugs and then build fortunes destroying the lives of others. That is not what I came here to do. I fought for freedom, he would say, but not for the freedom of people to kill each other with reckless abandon, not for the freedom of children to have children and the fathers of the children walk away from them and abandon them as if they don't amount to anything. I fought for people to have the right to work, but not to have whole communities and people abandoned. This is not what I lived and died for. My fellow Americans, he would say, I fought to stop white people from being so filled with hate that they would wreak violence on black people. I did not fight for the right of black people to murder other black people with reckless abandon.
What do you find effective about the excerpt that we just heard?
I think the setting itself is significant. It's in the South. I couldn't prove this now, but I think his Southern accent is a little more pronounced than it is on a normal news conference, a televised news conference. And also, of course, he is in a church, and I think he, you know, President Clinton spent a lot of time going to church in the South, and I think there's a rhetorical style reflected, a sermon style reflected in this speech. I think he's very comfortable giving this speech. It's a accepting audience. This was not going to be a major address. I'm sure there were cameras there, but this was not for live television. This was for a group that he felt very comfortable with. I sort of erroneously called it intimate. It's not so much that it's a one-on-one style of speaking. It's obviously a very rhetorically flamboyant speech, but he's very comfortable, and I think he feels that the audience is very accepting of him while giving the speech.
You're both at the Library of Congress and work with sound recordings. Now, In the early 1900s, there weren't many sound recordings, so if you have something from a president, it's a wonderful, special, rare thing to have. What with local television and radio, national television and radio, and then C-SPAN, you know, playing this kind of stuff all the time, there's zillions and zillions now of presidential comments. What's it like for you? Are you getting inundated with presidential speeches and other political speeches that you have to catalog?
Yes, we are. We are getting inundated. It's partially we welcome it. We would not want to have less. Of course, we would like to have more time and more people and more money to do it better, but I would certainly not want to see the flood stop. I think we're very privileged to live in an age where we can have this. And it's also very difficult to say what might not be important 20 years from now. So I think we have to take it all and catalog it and store it and preserve it best we can.
Sam Berlowski and Cooper Graham work with the Library of Congress's Division of Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound. They co-produced a CD of presidential speeches from the 20th century. Our interview was recorded in 1995 when the CD was first released. It's still in print. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.